This is Resonance 104.4 FM and on digital. This, as you might know by now, is The Sound of Photography, and I'm Frank Watson. As you know by now, I say it every week, but this show deals with everything to do with photography. I'm delighted to have here in the studio my guest, which is Jenny Lewis. Welcome to the show, Jenny.
Thanks for inviting me along, Frank.
You're welcome. Good to have you here. Jenny is a portrait photographer and her work is rooted in her Hackney community. She has published three monographs entitled One Day Young, Hackney Studios and 100 Years, and we'll speak about two of those later. Jenny has exhibited nationally and internationally in institutions including the National Portrait Gallery, the Open Eye Gallery and Photo 22 in Melbourne. Her work has been collected by the National Portrait Gallery, the Wellcome Collection and the Pallant House Collection. So we're going to start with Hackney, I thought, and you live in Hackney probably for quite some years, I imagine.
Yeah, I think it's nearly 30 years now.
Nearly 30, right. So tell us what the attraction of Hackney is in terms of your work.
Well, in terms of work and maybe in terms of life as well. I think when I moved to Hackney, it's the first time I really felt connected to a place. There was such a warmth there. And when I started making work there, I just felt, you send out those networks. You're trying to find your community. And by photographing them, it's a great way to
explore
that.
It's a passport into the community.
Yeah.
And most of your work, or certainly the earlier work, is about different social groups that you've come across. We won't talk about it today, but you photographed artists in their studio, so that was a way of connecting with those artists. You've done and we're going to come on to it later, you did a monograph about women who have just given birth, and also the other book, 100 Years, where you actually looked at everyone from 0 to 100 in a series of 100 portraits. So it strikes me you're sort of reaching out, trying to understand the community through your photographs. Is that right?
Well, I think it's probably trying to understand myself rather than trying to understand the community. So by...
Could you not be doing both?
Possibly. But I think by looking at so many different perspectives, you're trying to sort of understand where do you fit in amongst all of these things, and this sort of expansive curiosity about people. But I think really underlying all of that is a need to understand yourself through others, probably.
Right. And do you feel you've learned a lot through?
Oh, my goodness, so much. I mean, what conversations, that has got to be the best way to learn and spending time with people. And when you spend time with people taking their portrait, it's a very intimate, slow time where you're taking time to listen and have those one-on-one, very intimate conversations. It's the best way to learn.
And in a way, you know, what you take away from those conversations obviously is the experience of listening to other people, but the portrait that you take of these people becomes a sort of memory for you, would you say?
It is, really. It's kind of, it's the evidence of the conversation. It's the evidence of the collaboration between the two of us. So as much as I'm always trying to take an authentic portrait of the person opposite me, it's really capturing this collaborative process of the conversation, of how they're opening up and what they're taking from me and where that conversation's going. So that's why I find it really important that it's always just me. I don't have a big team of people with me. That's why all the personal projects boiled down to that real simplicity of no lights, me just going to their space. So there wasn't a lot of other people around. There wasn't the distractions of lighting, sure. Stylists, makeup, even a journalist. I ended up interviewing people myself as well because I just didn't want any distraction. It was just about the experience of the two of us and what came out of that and what bubbled to the surface. And then after the conversation, I suppose that's what you're capturing in the portrait, that their own reflections, where that conversation has taken you. That's what you're capturing in the portrait, and that's what you walk away with. That's what you're left with.
It strikes me there's always a gap between, well, in your work with any portrait photographer, between the conversation and the picture. Do you not feel sometimes that the picture falls short of the experience?
Yeah. And with One Day Young, my first book, I didn't interview people. It didn't feel appropriate. Mm. They'd just had a baby. I was photographing them within that first 24 hours. So I didn't want to interrogate them. I didn't want to stay too long. Mm. But I did feel when I finished that project that a lot of the magic that had happened in the room, I wasn't sharing with my audience. Sure. So with subsequent books and projects, I've found the interviews something that I really want to share as well, to kind of give you a glimpse. You know, I'm not going to share a two-hour interview and conversation. And, and some of it feels inappropriate to share because maybe they just wanted to speak about certain things in that room.
Yeah.
But I do like to share a fragment of that conversation to bring people in to their experience. And sometimes there's a real juxtaposition between the text and what you're looking at. And I find that really interesting, that sort of jarring. You think you're looking at one thing, which is really celebratory, but there's really an undercurrent of something else going on, which the words can bring to the surface.
Absolutely. I mean, I was thinking, I don't know if you wrote, you must have come across Roland Barthes' book, Camera Lucida. And at one point he says that when he's having his picture taken, that he talks about lending himself to a social game. I pose, I know I'm posing. And in a way, what he's inferring there is that you're setting yourself up to be photographed. It's like people saying, this is my good side or my bad side. So in the end, it strikes him as an act of almost performing for the camera.
Yeah.
And as soon as that happens, there's almost like, what he then goes on to say is the photograph fails to capture his character, his essence, his profound self. I mean, it's all quite philosophical and deep, but I think he has a sort of point that the photograph can only ever be a sort of surface reading.
I think that's the chase, isn't it? Mm. You know, photography is a failure to capture the real, authentic person.
Do you recognise that?
And that's what you're chasing, what you're chasing. That's what your dream is, to get the mask to slip and actually capture the person. Mm. And when I was a editorial photographer, that was always my goal, to try and make people, relax, be themselves, not be the performative self.
Right.
And when I did One Day Young, and I captured people, women, within the first 24 hours of having a baby, that's when I realised that non-performative self was on show. They were engulfed with endorphins that they didn't need to perform. They were actually there on the surface, not hidden. And that was a real kind of pivotal moment when I realised I didn't have to do all the tricks I used to do to try and make people relax. Right. They were sort of already at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, I think that's why that project and those portraits are so immediate. There is no performance. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that answers what you're asking.
We're going to play a piece of music. This is Mika Hinson. Is that right?
Yeah, Mika P. Hinson.
Mika Hinson, and it's called Don't You. So let's click cue that up.
There are They don't mean a thing anyway. They don't mean a thing anyway. No. And don't you forget about me. Forget about me. And don't you forget about me. Forget about me. Forget about me.
You're listening to The Sound of Photography, and I'm carrying on talking with Jenny Lewis. We're going to talk about two books that you've published, one in 2015 called One Day Young, which is it shows pictures of women within 24 hours of giving birth, so it's a brand new experience. And a more recent book in 2021, a book called 100 Years. As we said earlier, it's all about people in Hackney it's a series of 100 portraits from 0 to 100. And you even found a woman who was 104, is that right?
Yeah, 105, I think.
105, yeah. Makes you feel young. So we'll start with One Day Young. This is a series of portraits of women who very recently have given birth. I think this idea came about because of your own experiences, is that right?
Yeah, I felt like I had a baby and I was just, I felt so powerful when I had a baby. I felt like a warrior and I could take on the world and I could do anything. And I was just furious that I didn't know that I could feel like that, that what I'd been fed was, it's going to be the most distressing thing you've ever done, it's going to be the most painful, it's going to be the most difficult. And I was like, why didn't no one tell me it could be wonderful? You could be, you know, empowered rather than...
It sounds like you had quite a negative people around you.
Just society. It's not just people, it's the medical profession, it's Yeah, I think it's just a societal thing, and I was just really angry that it didn't feel very supportive, and actually I could have been given a seed of confidence. So I felt determined that if I had to pass on this message to other women, and I didn't really know how to do it, and I didn't know if other women did feel the same as me. So I just kind of had this idea that I would photograph women the day they had a baby within the first 24 hours and capture this magic, which I just intrinsically believed was there. And everyone said, how are you going to find these people? Who's going to let you in at this really like intimate moment into their homes? And I just felt like it would work and it would happen because I'd just done it, and I knew that I felt really proud of myself and I wanted to share this story.
How did you find your mothers?
So it was really, like I say, just blind belief. And I wasn't allowed to put up notices in hospitals or doctors because you'd need a police check. You're asking to go into people's houses. So I literally did that old-fashioned thing like when you're trying to sell a bike and you put a leaflet up in the chip shop saying, you know, if you want a free picture, here's my website, get in contact. And, you know, pull off my phone number and my email, like little tags that you could tear off. And I just put those leaflets everywhere I could think of that I was allowed to, you know, whether I was taping them onto trees in the park or into, you know, any corner shop. Right. And gradually people started contacting me and I'd photographed them. And that's why this book became Just Women in Hackney, because I couldn't get there quick enough because I was photographing them in daylight. So I also had children to look after and freelance photography projects and work to do. But if I got a call from someone, they could only obviously tell me the day they had the baby, so I had to be there immediately, jump on my bike and get there.
So it's like a hotline.
It was like a mad hotline that went on. I thought I'd do 10 just to kind of prove my point, and I'd worked in an editorial way, so 10 felt like a good number of case studies to then approach The Guardian or The Times to do a feature on this work. But the more I did, the more I realised that every woman I'd met was so interesting and their stories were so different that it was more than just an editorial feature. It was more than just 10. If I did 20, it would be better. If I did 50, it would be better.
how many are there?
There was 150 I photographed over 5 years, and there's 40 in the book because I was editing down to get that diversity of age. You can see in their homes, so I wanted an economic diversity of the kind of homes that I was in. And just different experiences. So I kept going until I felt like I'd filled the gaps. I think the last photograph I did was Xanthi, who was 17, and I'd been really hunting for a teenage mother. But they're often seen as vulnerable, so they're kept in the hospital for 4 or 5 days. Or I did photograph a girl in a hostel, but it felt too traumatic.
Were you photographing single mothers?
Yeah, every kind of mother you can imagine.
In the book, you wouldn't
you
know,
don't know
would
that.
You?
No, and there was single mothers, there was lesbian mothers, there was people who'd had cesarean sections, every kind of birth imaginable, home births. There was people that were on their fourth baby, people on their first baby, IVF babies, 17-year-old mother, 45-year-old mother. You know, I really tried to find everyone, but I didn't need to share that information because we were looking at these women saying everyone is going through the same experience. And you can see through the book, it's really similar body language again and again and again. So it becomes a kind of mantra of you're going to be okay, you're going to be okay. You can find yourself in these women. There's going to be someone that you relate to, you know, if you just keep going.
Yeah. I think part of what comes across, I think it's mentioned in the book, this idea of how you're a sort of shift in identity, that one minute you're a single woman who's relatively free, and all of a sudden you have a huge responsibility on your shoulders, and nothing can really prepare you for that, unless it's not your first child.
Yeah, but I think what sort of overwhelmingly came across is that I was walking into these strangers' houses and there was an explosion of love. And I'd never witnessed that with strangers before. The love of their baby, the love of their partner, the kind of respect for themselves of what they've just triumphed over. It was almost like walking into a battlefield, but kind of you know, they just physically triumphed over this challenge, and there in front of them, in their arms, was this baby, and there was just like a chemical reaction in the room.
It's sort of empowered.
Yes, so empowering. Yeah. And I just knew that if women could see this, who were, you know, younger women moving towards birth, it would give them confidence, because they'd go, oh, they're still themselves. They're not in the kind of hospital gowns in a sterile room with no identity. It's like identity intact.
Yeah.
In their homes, you can almost imagine their lives and what music's playing and what they like. They're still people, they're not anonymous.
Sure. I was thinking of, I know we spoke of this before, of Reneka Dijkstra's work, where, for people who don't know her work, it was about a series of women with their babies. But it's very quite clinical, isn't it? It's literally within, what, an hour or so of giving birth? I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's that same sort of immediacy. And I know that work, and I loved that work, but it didn't lend me any support when I was pregnant. And that was kind of the only art images I knew of the immediacy of birth. And they frightened me because the women looked sort of almost like they'd just been shot or run over. They're rabbit in a headlights. They look terrified.
They're reduced to types almost. I mean, that is a characteristic of Dijkstra's work, isn't it? A sort of typologies, you know.
And
unlike your work, which has a sense of intimacy.
It's almost like if those pictures feel like an out-of-body experience, a real severance and a shock. Mm. And what I wanted to show was this really landing in yourself and this kind of connection. And that's what I feel like women needed to see. I wanted to dilute the imagery around birth that I felt was kind of overwhelmingly about fear. And I didn't want to frighten women. I think they're frightened enough. Mm. We're always kind of bombarded with the negative. And I just thought, there's another side of this story. Mm. You know, you can see that you can do this, and your identity is intact. And in fact, you're more than rather than less than after this experience.
Because I think you chose just to use a few quotes in the book. So each photograph doesn't necessarily have a space for that mother to articulate their feelings.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was a conscious decision.
Yeah, I really wanted the pictures to speak for themselves and almost not be individual stories. I didn't want individual birth stories and to go into what had just happened. I just wanted you to sort of see the love and joy and competence and empowerment of these women. And then by leaving it quite open, you could find yourself within the pictures. And then the 12 quotes that run through it, they're not linked to individuals, but they just take you on a journey.
Yeah.
And they're just kind of dotted throughout, and they're just really beautiful thoughts, which I just thought would linger in people's minds. And they were from conversations had with the women.
Right. We could move on now. I mean, I think there's lots to say about. I mean, I think when I was looking at this book, I was aware how little, I would imagine, how little most people think about their own birth. I mean, it's a sort of ridiculous thing to say, but you don't actually think about the moment you come into the world, partly because you don't have the language or the way of going back to that place. But
and you don't think about how your mother felt.
No.
And what was going on in that room.
Yeah.
So, you know, capturing these moments, they're usually quite hidden, or they're kept in a family sort of family album. They're not usually put on a pedestal.
No.
And I wanted to bring them out of the domestic into the art world, into the open, for us to look at and celebrate. Mm. So it's kind of quite exciting. Some of that work now is going to... It's not been totally signed off, but it's going to happen. But there's a couple of collections in the UK that are inquiring about One Day Young at the moment. So hopefully that will happen this year.
What,
that it'll
buying the collection?
Yeah, probably.
Or some of it.
8 to 10 for each two different collections.
So you have to get clearance for that from the mothers.
I've got all the model releases. It was always like these images will be used as artwork in a book and in art galleries, and everyone knew what they were going to be used for at the time.
Oh, right. Let's move on to your second book in 2021, 100 Years. As we've already said, that's
the third
going
book,
from
Frank.
Naught
we've missed one.
Going from naught to 100. I mean, it's quite a, to use a cliche, it's quite a journey, isn't it? Where you start with the the baby. I mean, the first picture's amazing because the baby is sitting in a chair.
I know,
and
isn't
it looks
cute?
Like a little old man already. I mean, babies often look like little old people. And obviously, and in this book, each page has a quote with it, which would say, you know, an anecdote about their life or their hopes or their dreams or their experiences. But the first picture, because it's a baby before speech, is sort of nothing.
Yeah, which is quite wonderful. And what was kind of brilliant is you can't plan it. Again, this was, I probably took 300 photos to get the 100, to get the diversity of stories and diversity of pictures. But that first one of Herb in a green armchair, and the last one of Rini, who's 100, she's also in a green armchair. I mean, obviously not planned or styled, but what beautiful bookends to these 100 different personalities. So that was just chance, but it's like they work really well together. I did an exhibition recently, and I had those two next to each other, and I really loved sort of seeing them together.
Right. And, yeah, I mean, you seem to leave open what... I mean, I don't know whether you were... The quotes that you choose, are they plucked from a conversation or... I mean, were you recording the conversations?
Yeah, so by the time that was the third book, like we were saying earlier, by the time I got to the third book, I felt the words were really important.
Right.
So I would interview people and record it on my phone, and it was I never had a set list of questions. We'd just have a conversation, and the right thing would bubble to the surface. And some people it'd be 20 minutes, some people it'd be 2 hours. It's just depending what. Where they, you know, how much they wanted to divulge and where we were going with the conversation. And then from that, it was really quite a lot of work to find the quotes. Because you're talking about the rhythm of 100 pages that you're going through, and you don't want to repeat yourself. So it's kind of the arc of the book leads, you know, which extract I pull out, or even which subject I choose, because obviously I had to, like, lose about 200 pictures and interviews to really get that kind of lovely meandering tale of life and humanity.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing was I found myself going to the page where of the age that I am now.
It's so funny. So many people do that. I hadn't thought of it, but so many people want to see what's going on around their time of life.
And what people look like for their age.
Yeah. I don't know. Are we always just looking for ourselves, you know?
Well, yeah, a bit of a mirror almost, isn't it? Yeah. So once again, I'm intrigued about how you rounded up all these people, because you have to ask them specifically, you know, how old you are.
Yeah, it's a weird question.
So how did it happen?
A lot of the times I went up to complete strangers in the street and tried to explain in the kind of politest way, I'm gathering 100 people, portraits for a book, and I need to get every age. Would you be interested? And then as I'm talking to them, you know, get them to tell me how old they are. But which was fine in the beginning because I had 100 people to find. But as I went along, obviously it was very specific. I need a 47-year-old and a 73-year-old, and I've just done three women, so I need a man, and I've just done, you know...
You needed a spreadsheet.
I had post-it notes in my office, a grid of 100. And then when I'd done someone, their name and a little picture of them took the place of the post-it note. And then I gradually kind of filled in this grid. Then I could see where I'd repeated myself. And I'm like, OK, I need to do age 8 again. It's too similar to age 7. And I just kept kind of pulling people in and out that way.
Are you good at maths?
It's not maths. It's visual, isn't it? It's visual. It was on the wall, you know, fill the gaps. And then, of course, I could get the visual difference, you know, not easily, but I could get a visual difference. But then when I interviewed them, I didn't ever know what someone's story was. And then you'd feel like, oh, that experience is quite similar to the three experiences I've just done around that age. I need to find something different. So that was quite difficult.
Yeah.
But I'm quite kind of stubborn and tenacious and just had to keep going. It was quite hard to find. So I could find people my own age. You know, that's my world. I could find people my kids' age. But finding younger people was difficult at that time. Finding older people, because it was... we were moving into lockdown, and all the clubs where I was finding older people shut down quite quickly. So I was going to posh club and volunteering waitressing so that I could meet people and talk to them, or I'd go to chair yoga where I'd meet sort of some 80-year-old ladies. But all those clubs shut down, so it became quite difficult. But luckily, a GP helped me. Yeah, and he suggested some of his patients and put me in touch with them, so I'd actually visit them at home. So that's how I found some of the older people.
And are there certain pictures or certain meetings with these people that stick in your mind?
I mean, Rini was incredible, the 100-year-old. Yeah. At the end, you know, she had such a cackly Cockney accent, which I can't put on for you. But the recording's absolutely brilliant with her giggling away.
A life force.
Such a life force. You know, she'd married a gangster. She'd had, you know, she'd dealt with domestic violence. She'd started a new job on a market stall when she was 75 down at Columbia Road. She told me about her new boyfriend. You know, she was just absolutely wonderful to spend time with. Yeah. And there's other stories, like I think it's around 34 or 35, you meet Rosie with a baby. And you think what you're looking at is like one of the One Day Young images, a celebration. But actually, when you read the words, you realise that she found out she had stage 4 cancer while she was pregnant. And suddenly, you know, the image becomes something quite different. Mm. So there's this, yeah, there's an arc through the book and you think you know what you're looking at, and then the words kind of, you
undermine
know, undermine that. Yeah. And that, as life does, you know, you think you know where you are, and then something comes along and there's always that kind of jolt. So that's what I was trying to do with the book, kind of like, yeah, reflect life, I suppose.
Were there any difficult ones where you sort of felt sort of this is an interesting character, but it there was a sort of tension between you and the,
not that I that, can think of. I mean, no. There was a really wonderful one. I was kind of really drawn to this guy, Rick, who was 70-something, and he was running a volunteer, like, oldies do tech or something. You know, he was the leader of it. He wasn't one of the service users, but there was something about him, he was so awkward and sort of odd, and I was like, God, I'm really drawn to this guy. So I asked if I could photograph him, and we photographed him, and he had this kind of mad awkwardness about him. And then when we did the interview, he told me that he'd been street homeless for 15 years and actually then squatting for another 30 years. And there was such a... It was a brilliant interview, and he was a really interesting guy. He was kind of a extroverted introvert.
Defensive,
really
at first.
Defensive.
Yeah, as you would be if you'd been homeless.
Yeah, and he really understood being othered and being looked down on and being invisible.
And he's a white male, isn't he?
Yeah. But it was wonderful how, through all of that and that sort of bitterness, his real motivation was for people to not feel loneliness, probably because he'd felt so much. So he ran these amazingly generous groups.
Right.
So really, I mean, people would go along so they could get help with their tech, but really it was like a tea and a biscuit, and it was about community and sort of battling loneliness, and so people had somewhere to go. So it was a surprising story from him, and I think that often happened. You know, I thought somebody looked one way, and then what they told me was something quite different.
Yeah.
So I suppose it goes back to what you said earlier, is like, you know, these life lessons, these conversations.
Sure. Okay, we're going to play a bit more music. This is, I think, quite fitting from the first book, which is, and it's Child of Mine by Laura Marling. I need to adjust the volume for a second here. Be with you any minute. Okay, I think we're ready.
No. Still as strong as I can make it. plus your mind. So who would rush right through it, child of mine, child of mine, child of mine. Everything you want is in your reach right now. Anything that's not, I have to teach somehow. Everything about you is intuitive. So those who miss the point might rush right through it. 'Cause it's fine. Child of mine. Last night in your sleep you started crying. I can't protect you there though I keep trying. Sometimes you'll go places I can't get to. I've spoken to the angels who protect you, 'cause you're mine. They cast their golden light across this child, child of mine, child of mine, child.
You're listening to Resonance 104.4 FM on digital. This is Still the Sound of Photography. And my guest continues to be Jenny Lewis. We're going to shift into another more recent project of yours called Unbecoming. This is slightly different because it's a set of images of you by you. So in other words, they're self-portraits. And then from what I understand, it's about dealing with midlife. I don't want to use the word crisis. Can you think of a better word?
Yeah, well, it's definitely prompted by midlife, menopause, hormonal shifts.
Right.
So I guess it's about transition again. And when I've sort of, I mean, I've just felt compelled to make this work. I didn't really want to make it, but it just like, oh, it just came out. But when I look back at why I'm making it, I realise that actually that transition into motherhood was such a kind of shift, a tsunami of your identity changing. And then it sort of happens again with women. Mm. In the female experience, there's another tsunami, or your identity kind of dissolves and you're no longer that mother identity.
Mm. And it's not a set age. It's like giving birth, really. You know, it can happen.
Exactly.
Over there's a range of years.
Just a shift. And when we were talking about it the other day, I was thinking it's not just menopause. It's just at midlife, like I said, your identity from being the mother kind of shifts. That's not required anymore. And then there's the
because your children are growing.
Older, moving out, moving on.
Yeah.
And then there's the kind of hormonal and chemical shift that's going on in a woman's brain and body. And then there's aging. But then there's also been the shift of the language of photography as well. You know, my career has changed so much. You know, photography is not as valued in the same way, or there's not kind of... it hasn't got the stability around it, the career. So that
because of digital.
Well, just because the future of photography has changed. So, you know, the career is dissolving as well. So I just found myself a couple of years ago in this position where nothing made sense anymore. I didn't understand. I was an alien to myself. So I couldn't make work in the same way anymore. So I mean, I didn't want to do a self-portrait. I really had no interest in putting myself in front of the lens. But there was something about this resistance that made me question it. And it's like, why? Why is my experience not worthy of being captured? Why shouldn't I take up space? I'm always looking at other people. I'm always interested and curious.
Was that because you're self-conscious about, your, like we all are, you're self-conscious about your own looks?
Oh, 100%. I mean, yeah. I don't think I've looked in a mirror for 20 years. I just, there's been a real disconnect with the body. Right. And I really had to face what the hell was going on. And I have, whilst doing the work, I have realised that I was diagnosed with an autoimmune disease about 16 years ago. And I think that is the severance.
That catapulted its way in. Yeah.
A disconnect with an unreliable body that doesn't work, and I rejected it. So I carried on in my head making work in a cerebral way, but kind of in an out-of-body way. I just kind of like, well, that's not the destiny I imagined. I was like into kickboxing and running, and suddenly all of that was taken away. So I rejected the body and didn't want to be in an image or a mirror. And so... I don't know.
So there's a sense of denial and what?
Massively, rejection. So something happened at this time of life, and like I presume it's triggered by menopause. It just sort of makes everything shift. And I just felt compelled to put myself in front of the lens and confront myself. Mm. And actually, I suppose it's a journey of reconnection.
Did it work?
Absolutely. Yeah, it has worked. I feel like... there was so much fear going on. There was such a monster under the bed that I didn't understand and didn't want to face.
And in the bed.
but by pulling it all out and confronting it visually and thinking about it, like why I'm making the work, what it's all about, has definitely kind of dissipated that fear, and it's dissolved. And it was an empowering process, actually.
Give us a sense of what those pictures would look like, because it's quite hard to imagine on the radio, week we have them.
I would say they're really quite brutal. They're very close up. There's no flattering going on. You know, through my career, I've learned how to make people feel comfortable and how to get the best photo, a flattering photo. And I had no interest in flattering myself. I didn't need to. You know, self-portraiture is a brutal... it's a brutal game. You know, you're sort of having this weird little fight of how far can you push it? And it's, you know, I didn't want to hide. I didn't actually think I'd show anyone the pictures either. So I had that freedom that I could do whatever I wanted. They are quite brutal. There's nothing flattering going on there. But there is such an honesty that I find them really compelling now, you know, although I couldn't really look at them to start with.
So at the time, you wouldn't have thought of showing these pictures in a gallery or in a magazine, but that changed, didn't it?
Well, I didn't think anyone would be interested. Right. I wasn't interested.
So what caused the change?
For a starting point. I just couldn't leave them alone. And sort of, there was just something going on there that I couldn't do with someone else. I couldn't make a picture like that with someone else. And when I showed other people, they were really struck with them, that there was such a resilience and strength in the pictures rather than vulnerability. And I entered one to the Taylor Wessing. I think it was
the National Portrait Gallery, which is on at the moment, actually.
I think it was in, I can't remember what year it was, a couple of years ago. And the self-portrait got in. And seeing it in the gallery walls, it sort of changed. It's almost not me anymore. It's a moment of resilience and confrontation and vulnerability, and how vulnerability and fragility can actually...
So it was just one picture.
Think about
showed.
Strength. Yeah, just one picture
and
at that point.
I'm interested in the... I presume there might have been a label with it. Did you call it a self-portrait? So people... because if you didn't, people wouldn't know.
I did. calling it self-portrait.
So they would know.
And the title of the series, Unbecoming, is really important. I love playing with words. And sort of to unbecome is talking about this unravelling of the identity, to undo something, to unknot something. And also unbecoming sounds very unattractive. You know, it's almost like moving towards the abject, which in photography you're usually beautifying things and flattering things and being decorative almost. And I had no interest in that anymore. So I had to kind of recreate this language of photography.
So photographically you're stripping things away as well in a way because you're... You know, you're questioning your whole sort of aesthetic approach.
Exactly. And sort of, you know, I've just come out of the shower, so there's no sort of makeup, there's no hair, there's no clothes. You're not building up this performative portrait like we talked about earlier. It's all stripped back. And even the water on the skin, it's something about sort of washing all of that away, like a rebirth. Mm. Like there's a very sort of, the nature of the whole project is very slippery and... water seems to be very important in it all, like I suppose like a metamorphosis, like a liquefied state. So all the elements are still there, but they're having to be sort of recalcified in a different way, a process.
Do you think it, in terms of shedding off things to sort of, as you say, almost to rebirth yourself, you know,
absolutely.
To find a new version of yourself?
Yeah, there's an untangling of different identities that women seem to, or maybe just me personally, have taken on over different stages of my life. And I just wanted to untangle the whole lot and drop it on the floor and just see what was left, what I'd ignored, what I'd kind of walked away from. And that reconnection has been really kind of, oh, it sounds a bit silly, but it's been really beautiful. I feel like I've gone full circle away from myself and found myself again, which you wouldn't think photography would be able to do. You know, it's quite a physical journey. But it's really, I do like thinking about like the language of photography and how I've used it to find my tribes and find myself. And sometimes it will be through other people. And now with this new work, it's been turning the lens on myself. And it's interesting how photography has always been the answer for me to as a comfort.
It's interesting because, as we said before, the photograph doesn't in some ways reveal as much as you want it to. And yet... if you look at these pictures long enough, you do start to have your own internal monologue about what's going on here. Why am I looking at these pictures? How does it affect me? You know, you're actually projecting a sort of text over the picture, aren't you, really?
Yeah, I think my work now seems to be moving towards not just what's in front of me, but like a psychological landscape. I feel that's what I'm dealing with more, rather than just the surface
appearance
of something and what it looks like and what it makes you feel. It sort of seems to be digging a little bit more underneath, so they feel like psychological portraits. So it's almost like it doesn't matter if it's me or not. In the series, there's a few of my daughter and we look quite similar. And again, like when I look at the ones of Ruby, it's like, am I looking at my past self? Or there's this hereditary thread between the two of us? There's a like female lineage. It's a genetic.
It also goes
link.
Back to that idea of aging, doesn't it?
I mean, and then there's the very physical,
seeing
obvious.
Your daughter in I don't know what she is, 20s or whatever, and seeing how that the skin changes, the face changes, the hair changes.
So then, what you're not just talking about two individual portraits of those particular people. You're talking about impermanence and mortality and the human condition and temporality, and that we're all on this journey of decaying.
Right.
And it's very much, it's all there under the surface, so it's not just the portraits.
Right. Well, quite fittingly, we've got David Bowie and the track is Where Are We Now? Which I think, you know, it fits rather well, doesn't it?
Had to get the train from Potsdamer Platz. You never knew that I could do that. Just walking the day. sitting in the jungle, remember the stars. A man lost in time near Cardiff, just walking the dead. Thousand people, crossbars and broken, fingers are crossed just in case, walking the dead.
Still with the sound of photography, and I'm still with Jenny Lewis. We're going to shift to your present project, which is about autoimmune disease, a disease as I understand it. And this again sees another shift in the way you're working. So perhaps you could introduce what you think you're doing with this new project, given that it's not resolved. I think you would, agree with that.
Yeah, it's a sort of a visual research project into autoimmune illnesses. And I wanted to challenge the way I was working. I keep feeling that I need to challenge the way I'm working, like it's not working right like that. I want to try a different way. So I kind of wanted to take the authority of the photographer out of me being the one holding the camera, pointing at someone and looking at them and interrogating them. I wanted to change that in some way. So I thought about gathering these case studies, these people that had autoimmune disease, and using an autophoto booth to capture them. So I don't hold the camera. The machines I'm using are those really old-fashioned ones where there's a mini darkroom in the back. So you can hear the kind of clinking and clanking of the rolls of paper going up and down into
their stock. So these are analog photo booths.
They're analog photo booths, and I used to be a black and white printer 100 years ago. So I like that thought of the smell of the chemicals and the cogs and the developing trays, and that sort of that hierarchy of the photographer and the sitter. I just wanted the machine to be the thing taking the picture, and like autoimmune diseases mean that you're living in a body that's really unreliable. It can let you down at any minute. There's basically your immune system is attacking itself. It's a very strange body to live in when you're, you know, you can't control your armies. They've turned on you. There's a mutiny. So it's a very strange kind of feeling to live in these bodies. And I haven't really spoken about it to other people because I don't know other people with autoimmune disease.
So you actually haven't started the project yet?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've photographed about 20 people. So I've been trying to find... And I also wanted to talk about hereditary guilt because autoimmune disease... you often get a predisposition for your kids to have autoimmune or it comes from your parents. It's a genetic predisposition. So I've felt this hereditary guilt of what am I passing on to those I love the most. And I've never heard anyone talk about this kind of feeling.
So you suffer from autoimmune yourself.
So I've got rheumatoid arthritis.
And have you always known that?
No, I got it when I was 32, so 16 years ago. My mum has colitis, so that's an autoimmune disease. And I don't know if my kids have something yet. It usually comes out a little bit later. So that's what I was sort of investigating. It was kind of the glitches in the body. I wanted the autophoto strips to capture. You know, they're not perfect. You can't control the lighting. You can't control how far you get back. You can't control the background. The chemicals might be a little bit exhausted, so then they're not as contrasty. So it's kind of taking control away from the photographer and away from the photograph and just like what will be because we've just got these diagnoses.
Yes, so I think like your other projects, you interview the people who suffer from this and you have a conversation with them and then you ask them to go to the photo booth. Is that right?
Yeah, I get people usually come to my studio and we'll talk for an hour about their condition and it's often that they've never spoken about it to their work colleagues, to their family. And talking to people, again, I've found another tribe and we all seem to have the same language, the way we talk about our illness and our bodies and the impermanence and the unreliability and the invisibility of it.
So you personalise it rather than medicalise it, for want of a better word.
Yeah, and
I think you find your own words, not the medical profession.
And people are describing how it makes them feel in society rather than just that my arm hurts or my shoulder's frozen. It's about this psychological otherness that happens or this battle within the self. So people have felt, I've found that a lot of people have found it really cathartic to actually talk about it in a really honest way, not with a doctor, not with a medical professional. And then we go to the booth together and it's almost like I've brought them to this place where they're reflecting on their unreliable body and they're having to confront themselves.
And the conversation you've had with them.
Yeah. And then they go into the booth and it feels like a confessional booth because I'm not in there. I'm not facing them. The curtain's shut and they can see their own reflection in the mirror. So they're sort of controlling it in a way, but just whatever comes out, comes out. So it's a visual research project where I'll use the strips and the interviews.
Yeah. Great. Well, we look forward to hearing that. We've come to the end of the show and I want to thank you, Jenny, for coming in. It's been really interesting. I want to thank Richard and Rose for engineering. And I could almost thank myself for being here as well. But if you want to find Jenny's books, they're with Hoxton Mini Press and I'm sure they're still available. We're going to play out with Miriam McCabe, a track called Patter Patter, not Pasta Pasta.
resonance.